Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. With midterm elections fast approaching, candidates of both parties have locked onto a key group of voters, small business owners. Many are still reeling from the Great Recession, but it's this group that could offer a hope for reducing the nation's unemployment rate. Joining me to talk about small businesses, what they do and do not need from Washington to promote growth, Jacob Hacker. He's professor of political science at Yale University. Elizabeth Williamson, she's a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. And Bill Risch, he's tax counsel for the National Federation of Independent Business. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. We already have a few messages posted on Facebook. You can also join us on Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
And Bill Risch, if I could start with you, begin, if you would, to define what is a small business.
Sure. Well, we represent the National Federation of Independent Business, exclusively small businesses. Our membership, well over 300,000 small business owners, is the largest small business advocacy organization in the country. In terms of what is a small business, it becomes a little bit harder to dig down and define exactly what is and isn't a small business. But in terms of industry, I mean, you're going to find small businesses in just about every industry, from retail shops to small manufacturers to small doctor's offices. So they're in every community, every town in the country. In terms of how many there are or how you define them, if you just look through some of the data out there, there are about 29 million tax returns that are filed every year with some form of business income reported on that return. So that's sort of where the confusion begins in terms of defining a small business. When you begin to dig down from that, there are about 16 million individuals out there who are self-employed, basically meaning they employ themselves, they run their own business. And there are about 6 million small employing firms. And so when you talk about firms that are employing, about 6 million small employing firms out
there. Okay. You've given me numbers. Mm-hmm. What about income? Mm-hmm. What about how large mm-hmm. a small business can be and still call itself a small business?
Well, when you go with the SBA definition, the SBA defines a small business as 500 or fewer employees. So there are a couple of different places sort of throughout the law where you can find definitions of a small business. 500 is the SBA definition. There's also a definition in the tax code that goes by the gross receipts, which is, I think, $5 million in gross receipts over the course of 3 years. So there's a couple of different definitions in the law for the SBA programs. The 500 is the threshold in terms of employees, but for certain tax provisions, you look at this gross receipts number. So there are a couple of different definitions in the law.
So, for example, if you had a law firm of 500 lawyers, it would depend then on how much money they brought in as to whether they were defined?
Well, that would be for two different things. I mean, for an SBA program, you'd be looking at the number of employees. For some of the tax issues, mostly what kind of accounting system you use, you'd be looking at the gross receipts. So depending on which law you're looking at, you're going to look at the different size.
Okay, but if you're looking at two different laws, which is going to prevail?
Well, again, it depends on which you're applying to.
See, this is why I have this problem. Yeah. This is why millions of Americans, I think, are confused about what is a small business. Elizabeth, how do you see it?
Well, Diane, out on the campaign trail and when you travel with the president or talk to small business people, you find that being a small business is much more a state of mind than it is a number of employees or the amount of money you bring in a year. And most small businesses, I think, consider themselves to be far fewer than 500 employees and far fewer than $5 million in revenues over 3 years. And that is where you really hit the rub, or the rubber meets the road, if you will, on regulations. Those are the businesses for which one regulation is a make-or-break type situation. And in this election, what they're doing is sort of betting the farm in supporting a candidate that they feel will roll back some regulations that threaten their businesses.
Give me an example.
Sure. One is Rick Woldenberg, who I visited in Vernon Hills, Illinois, a Chicago suburb. Rick owns Learning Resources Incorporated, which is a small toy educational products and toy business. And what he's struggling with is the Consumer Product Safety Commission rule on the lead content in children's products. This is a fairly straightforward rule, but when it's interpreted into regulations, it's led to a lot of confusion and a lot of compliance costs for his company. They've never been cited for lead issue. They've had one small recall in 30 years of business, 40 years of business. But what they're doing is struggling with labeling their products, trying to define what is a children's product. A certain type of a pen, if it has Elmo on it, is a children's product. The very same pen without Elmo on it is not a children's product. That sort of thing. So he feels that this law, as it's interpreted gradually into regulations, is going to put him out of business. So he's begun raising money for a Republican, a real upstart candidate, who's running against one of the Democratic authors of the law in the district next door to his business.
Okay, so what about monies given to the campaigns? Pretty much split between Democrats and Republicans.
If you look at disclosed figures, Diane, we were almost at $1 billion contributed by business groups, split evenly. About 53% of that money goes to Democrats. But if you look at undisclosed contributions, and this has been the source of controversy in this election, the money that goes to the Chamber of Commerce, that goes to various so-called C4 groups like American Crossroads, Crossroads GPS, that's about $300 million so far, and that overwhelmingly favors Republicans.
And turning to you now, Jacob Hackery, he is the author of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. For whom does Washington work and for whom does it not?
Well, thanks for having me on, Diane. And I wanted to say right up front, this book was written with my co-author, Paul Pearson. And in the book, we basically argue that Washington has been much more responsive to the wealthiest of Americans and big business over the last generation than it has been to the middle class and to small business. I mean, if we were to complete that title, and it's already long enough, we might say how Washington stopped working for the middle class and for Main Street economy. Because if we look at this current downturn, it's really the workers and small employers that employ them that are really suffering. And they're feeling the same kind of anger and angst and pain, I think, that many Americans are in this current downturn. And the real challenge is to think about, well, if our economy isn't working very well for the small business sector as well as the middle class, first of all, why is that politically? I mean, 84% of Americans have a positive image of small business, and most Americans believe that the middle class is not just small business, but the middle class is the backbone of the economy. But we've seen over the last generation that most of the gains of economic growth have really gone to a tiny slice of people. And in fact, one of the interesting stories that we'll probably get into today is that those small businesses that are often being talked about, some of the big money is really in hedge funds and law firms, in the winners in the winner-take-all economy that we write about. So when people think about small business, as Elizabeth said, it's really a symbol of an economy that's where prosperity is broadly shared, that supports entrepreneurship and economic growth. And so when they talk about how small business is being hurt, they're often really talking about how the middle class is being hurt in this economy.
You know, it's so interesting because both small and large businesses were hurt during the meltdown of 2008. But yesterday, we hear that JPMorgan Chase, third quarter profits rose 23%. It's as though what happened hurt somebody, but not everybody, exactly as you say, Jacob.
Yeah, we could talk about this as like a tale of two economies, or just like a tale of two cities, because there's the Main Street economy where Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, where businesses aren't hiring. But there's also this Wall Street economy, which parts of which I think has spilled over into the business world. I would say that some of the top CEOs at big corporations rely more on Wall Street and its performance than they do on Main Street.
So, Bill, why do you
just sort of playing off with something Jacob said. He said what Washington is doing for the economy. I think part of the problem with small business is going through is what is Washington doing to small business? And this is part of the challenge. We talk about something like the regulations that Elizabeth was talking about. Our average membership, going back to what is a small business, is about 8 to 10 employees. The ability to deal with things like this lead paint issue for a smaller firm, if you have a small business, if you have a toy shop that has 10 employees and you've got to take everything out of your inventory and try to find the place where where those things have to be screened, nothing was really thought through as to how is it that we go out and meet this. The laudable goal of ensuring that toys are safe for children is a good policy decision. But the problem becomes the implementation of that. And when the implementation of that becomes such that smaller firms are put at that kind of a disadvantage, that's the real problem we're seeing coming out of Washington. That is just a small example. We've had situations with smaller construction firms. Construction is a big source of small businesses. There are a lot of smaller firms that have sprung up, and part of that has been the boom in housing. You know, there's opportunities to do drywall, lay pipes, do electrical work. It's been a great opportunity for entrepreneurship in that sector of the economy, for small firms to come along, for people to go out and strike their own way. But some of the regulations that have come down dealing with the construction industry has been to the detriment of those businesses when they're trying to latch on and come back.
Bill Risch, he's tax counsel for the National Federation of Independent Business. We'll take just a short break. Right back. And we're back talking about small business, the politics that are affecting small business, the economic reforms, the taxes, the health care, all of that affecting not only small but large business as well. Elizabeth Williamson, as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, you were talking earlier about a small company where one individual, a toy maker, toy business, moving his vote from Democrat to Republican because he was concerned about lead content and the Consumer Product Safety Commission. What about health care? What about taxes? Are those also issues that small business owners are really concerned about?
Absolutely, Diane. When I was traveling with this toy manufacturer, we went to a small business breakfast in Chicago where businesses stood up and they gave a series of candidates their concerns. And chief among them was a provision in the healthcare law that requires small businesses to file a 1099 for any vendor of goods or services valued at more than $600. They used to have to file this for services only, and now they're faced with just this amazing amount of paperwork. The administration itself, the White House, has sent Secretary Geithner from the Treasury and Kathleen Sebelius from Health and Human Services to persuade Congress to try and roll this back or at least minimize the paperwork. This is one of the unintended consequences of the health care bill for small businesses that they're very upset about, other than the costs of health care itself.
Bill, how do you see it?
Well, when we talk about the issues that are most important to small business right now, it's the cost of health care, it's taxes, and it's spending. And that's exactly right. And the provision like the 1099 thing is really the perfect example of Washington not thinking about how a small business operates. You know, it's 66% more expensive for a small business rather than a large business to file their taxes. When you add on something like this 1099 burden, that becomes exponentially higher. Small businesses don't have an accounting department. They don't have a finance department. A lot of times the paperwork's being done by the owner. They're doing it at night. You know, you're making muffins in the bakery in the afternoon with your workers. At night, when the shop closes, you're trying to fill out all these tax forms. This changes the equation about how much paperwork a business owner has to do. Tax paperwork is the most expensive paperwork burden the federal government places on small business, an average of about $74 per hour when you consider how much time you have to spend with your accountant or your agents to figure out what your tax liabilities are. That becomes a big problem.
So take, for example, this proposed $200,000 to $250,000 tax limit for individuals. How would that affect small businesses?
Well, the current tax rates, the expiration of the current tax rates is a big concern for small business.
Right.
About 75% of small business owners are structured in a way that they pay tax on their business income at the individual level. So those individual rates are very important. Keeping those individual rates low are very important to small business owners. We at the NFIB and what our members are telling us is we got to extend those current rates. No small business right now should face a tax increase. And that should include those businesses that report over $250,000. That oftentimes is operating capital. It's not money that the business owner takes home to spend on whatever he wants. It's money that tends to get plowed back in the business. And when we've talked to members, when we've talked to small businesses, and we've dug a little deeper into this, and like I said, the IRS data can be confusing, so we sort of dug through that and went straight to small business owners and asked them. Businesses that employ between 20 and 250 workers, about 40% of those businesses are going to be reporting that amount of income. Those businesses account for one quarter of the American workforce. So at a time when we're talking about 9.6% unemployment, businesses account for 25% of the American workforce, shouldn't be looking at a tax increase.
Jacob.
Well, I think this is an example of what Paul and I write about in the book. That is a real distortion of who's the real beneficiaries of these kinds of tax changes. The fact is that the tax upper income tax cuts that we're talking about are really going to go to the richest of the rich. Fully, I think it's something like $130,000 tax cut per millionaire, people who make more than $1 million a year. When you look at small businesses, even the Republican leader, John Boehner, admitted very, very few will be affected, something like 3%. And at the same time, it is true that those 3% of small businesses have a lot of money. Apparently, they make up something like 50% of all the income reported at that level. But what we should understand from that is that this isn't really what we have in mind when we talk about small business. So small businesses are basically a cover for more tax cuts for the really rich. We're talking here about companies like Bechtel, PricewaterhouseCoopers, large hedge funds and law firms. And in fact, we're talking about people like President Barack Obama, who's author royalties. He reports as small business income. So one of the things that I think people don't understand very well is that over the last generation, the richest of the rich have just shot into the economic stratosphere. And part of the reason they're doing so well is that government has helped them. It's cut their tax rates even as middle-class Americans have struggled. And this is just another example in my mind of a kind of distortion of the reality to try to shower more and more largesse on the very richest.
Well, okay. If I could just really quick, you know, when we talk to our members, these aren't just those companies. We're talking about small construction firms, small manufacturing firms. We hear this from business owners that fall outside that category. And these are people that are creating jobs, but it's a tough economic environment. And this is not the time to be raising taxes on
those
businesses.
And we're joined now by phone by Rick Poor. He's the owner of a small business in Lincoln, Nebraska. Good morning, Rick.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, sir. Tell us about your business. How many employees do you have?
We have 30 employees. We're a screen printing and embroidery business in Lincoln, Nebraska. We do business across the country pretty much. Got 30 employees, and that's about it.
Okay. What I want to know is your own reaction, your own thoughts about extending the tax cuts for small business people like yourself.
Well, you know, I've been listening to the conversation, and I'm not sure whether anybody on the panel has actually run a small business, but I've got to tell you, I'm a little confused about what a small business is as far as the number of employees.
So
if I had 250 employees, I'd think I was a big business. But we don't wake up every morning and wonder about the tax code or anything. You know, we wake up every morning and start running to run our businesses. And I really do believe that anybody that shows a $250,000 profit at the end of the year needs to fire their accountant. I mean, it's just there's a little thing called tax planning. And when the one gentleman was talking about we put money back in the business, yeah, that's how we reduce that taxable income. I'm just a little confused about when you start talking about 500 people being a small business.
Okay.
It's just not a small business.
Okay. Let me ask you, Rick, how much do you make each year in annual sales?
Well, you know, any small business is going to be an S corporation or a partnership, but that money is going to funnel down through, and we're going to have that income on our bottom line as an individual. I make less than $100,000 a year. We do about $2.5 million in sales, and I pump as much of that money. You know, when at the end of the year, if I'm looking at $130,000-$140,000 profit, I'm going to invest that money in the equipment. I'm in Vegas right now buying a $90,000 press. I've hired 4 people in the last 5 months. Business is good.
Good.
And if I listen to the news too much, I'm afraid I think otherwise.
Okay, the Bush era tax cuts on the top two brackets are ended, how is that going to affect you?
It won't. It won't affect the only people that's going to affect is, like the one gentleman saying, is hedge fund managers and lawyers, maybe some doctors. But let's get this in perspective. We're talking about a 4% and calling it an increase, rolling back the cut in taxes that Bush brought about. 4%. That's still 10% less than the great tax cutter Ronald Reagan.
All right, Rick Poor. He's the owner of a small business in Lincoln, Nebraska. Jacob Hacker, how do you react?
Oh, I think Rick makes a good point that for most business owners, this isn't their central concern when they wake up each morning. You know, to go back to something that we were talking about before, healthcare is really front and center. The NFIB's own surveys show that it's the number one concern. And yes, there are these unintended consequences of the bill, but there are intended consequences as well. I think 4 million small business owners received a letter from the IRS. And it was telling them something good, that they were getting a tax credit to provide health insurance under the new bill. The bill does not require that small business owners provide coverage. It is going to allow small business owners in 2014 to get coverage to these new health insurance exchanges where they might be able to get cheaper private options. And in fact, surveys that were done during the healthcare debate showed that small business owners were actually pretty favorable to the idea of having shared responsibility between employers, workers, and insurers. So my view is that is that a lot of this debate is driven by the fact that we're in the worst economic downturn still since the Great Recession. And, of course, small business owners are hurting. They're hurting far more than those at the very top. They're hurting like the middle classes.
Elizabeth.
I think on the health care issue, it was interesting in that it wasn't so dire a picture when you actually talk with small businesses, in that they were still hopeful that by 2014, when a lot of these provisions kick in, that they would benefit, and that they are able to look at a fact sheet distributed by the White House that will explain that they do derive some benefit from this bill. But as these sort of unintended consequences pile up, as the administration makes adjustments, for example, to provisions that were preventing some employers or at least making it very expensive for employers to provide part-time employees with health care, that sort of thing, this lends itself to uncertainty. And uncertainty is really the death knell of any business of any size. And this is something that I found that small business owners were complaining about most frequently, that they just are unable to predict what this bill holds for them in the future.
You know, and when you dig into the details of that health care bill, we talk about the small business tax credit for health insurance. Rick in Nebraska doesn't get the tax credit. He has too many employees. You can only have 25 employees and get that tax credit. So Rick doesn't get it. So it really doesn't help that many small businesses. But they sent out 4 million cards, but those 4 million cards were just sort of to tell you, hey, you might get this. When you actually dig into the details, very few small businesses get it, and it is so small, it's not going to have any impact.
Bill, she's tax counsel for the National Federation of Independent Business. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The question that seems to come up an awful lot on the political hustings is, if you extend these tax credits to small business owners earning over $250,000, that they will then hire more employees. However, Congressional Budget Office has said that extending or increasing this after-tax income typically does not create much incentive for them to hire more workers in order to produce more, because production depends principally on their ability to sell their products. Elizabeth.
Yes, that's absolutely true, Diane. There's been survey after survey that has said, the Business Roundtable, for example, just did a survey of business owners, and they're larger in size, but those results mirror what small business owners say, and that's that there definitely is this element of uncertainty. There's also the fact that sales are what drives hiring. If sales don't go up, they will not hire. And you see this with the $1.8 trillion that big businesses are holding. They'll use that as a sort of stick to get what they want in terms of the tax code. But the bottom line, when you survey them in a serious way, is that if they don't have greater demand for their products, then they will not hire.
Why are these big corporations holding on to so much money, Elizabeth?
Well, I think they give different reasons at different times, but essentially what they're doing is waiting for, and it depends on the type of business as well, but they are waiting for sales to improve. They are waiting to see the results of some of these policies come down the pike. They are waiting for changes in the tax code. They're pushing for a total overhaul of the tax code. And they're also looking for the administration to make some moves in the direction of doubling exports over the next 5 years, as the president has pledged to do.
Yeah. You know, when we look at we do a monthly economic survey of small business owners, and the number one problem since the beginning of this recession has been lost sales. That continues to be the persistent number one problem. But following not far behind that is uncertainty. Lost sales is a lot harder to deal with from a policy perspective. But that uncertainty that business owners are talking to us about are uncertainty about their tax rates, uncertainty about their health care costs, uncertainty about their energy costs, uncertainty about government spending. That's something Washington can do something about, and they haven't. They've only made those problems worse. That's something they could fix right away, and they haven't done that. There has to be a certain amount of time in terms of getting those sales back. But when you're living in this uncertain environment for the business owner, and you don't know what are going to be the cost of my health insurance because of the new health care law, do I have to fill out all these Form 1099s? What's my tax rate in January? Those are all uncertainties that you can't build into planning.
When you think about what Rick Poor said, he still doesn't understand what a small business is. I still don't understand whether there are limits to how much an individual proprietor can earn. I don't understand this, Jacob.
Well, I think you're not alone, and that's part of the reason why small businesses get bandied out as sort of as a reason for some of these upper income tax cuts. For most people, their image of small businesses, and it's certainly my image of small businesses, is of these small mom and pop operations or small entrepreneurial startups. And one of the things that I want to note is that the U.S., you know, it's part of the broader story that we tell in Winner Take All Politics, that the U.S. has done a very bad job of updating its policies to reflect the way in which the economy has changed. There's a need, for example, for more support for self-employed workers. The United States actually lags behind a lot of other rich democracies in helping entrepreneurial self-employed workers or small businesses, partly because our healthcare costs are just so high. So I agree completely that we have real problems with health, with energy and healthcare costs, and healthcare costs are a big part of the deficit problem that creates uncertainty. But I think what happened when President Obama came in is that he appealed to directly to large employers mostly to say, okay, we've got to tackle these long-term problems. And for a little while, there was sort of positive statements. But now I think big business and its lobbyists swung against financial market reform. They swung against healthcare reform. And I think small business might end up paying the price.
Jacob Hacker, he's co-author with Paul Pearson of Winner Take All Politics. We'll take a short break and be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Mark Laxer, author of The Monkey Bible, with an educational system that combines wildlife conservation and storytelling, monkeybible.com. By CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the effectiveness of charitable giving, at fjc.org. This is NPR.
The author of The Horse Whisperer, on how an ordeal with poisonous mushrooms influenced his new novel. It centers on an estranged father and son, each dealing with dark secrets and struggling with notions of bravery. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. As we talk about small business, as you may recall, during the last presidential campaign, Cindy McCain identified herself as a small business owner. Wikipedia tells us that the Hensley and Company, the Anheuser-Busch beer wholesaler that she owns, earned $340 million. It was founded in 1955. It has 650 employees. Help me out, Bill.
Well, I really can't speak to her business in particular, but you look at a lot of smaller businesses that are in the business of wholesaling. It's a very typical business. They've grown. And that's a good thing.
Well,
so if you start small and you get bigger, that's a good thing.
They've grown, but
that's what we want. We want job growth.
Yeah, of course we do. Here's an email from Mark, who says, I'm a CPA working in Birmingham, Alabama, and the way Republicans frame this debate is ludicrous. Let's use the example of a small business owner whose net income, gross receipts less expenses, is $250,000. His taxes will not go up if the portion of tax cuts for the wealthy are allowed to expire. Now let's look at the example of a small business owner whose net income is $350,000. How terrible will the expiration of the tax cuts be for him? He'll end up paying an extra whopping $3,000 a year. Is this what we are so upset about? How will this lead to the economic Armageddon that Republicans are predicting? Elizabeth, are Mark's figures accurate?
They sound pretty accurate to me, Diane. I think that this, to some degree, this small business aspect of the debate over the tax cuts is a canard. I mean, there are a number of small businesses that say that they will be impacted by this. But I think if you look at, you know, the basic Mr. Poor's definition of a small business, these guys aren't thinking about this. They're not going to feel it. It's not going to make a difference to them.
And here's another email from Karen, who says she's in Dallas. She says, I've owned my own business for 8 years. There are six of us in this small human resources consulting firm. We are not seeing client companies complaining about taxes. What they are complaining about is that they have no access to credit to expand the business, buy capital equipment, and hire more staff. They are sound businesses in a strong financial position, but financial institutions are not lending.
Yeah, it's a striking fact that even though there's all this cash at the top financial institutions, the president and Congress felt moved just recently to pass a bill that would extend $20 billion in loans to small businesses. Now, that may have been a good step for small businesses, but obviously it would be much better if these businesses were getting money through private sector means. Why isn't that happening? It's a real puzzle. Elizabeth and I were talking about it at the break, and a lot of the top CEOs are basically offering kind of disingenuous arguments about what's happening. I think part of what's happening is that right now things look pretty good for those CEOs, and they look pretty good on Wall Street, so there's no real need to rock the boat. I would just want to say one more thing about the tax cuts, because the debate's always framed about, you know, do you or do you not want a tax cut? And of course, we all want a tax cut, but it's not free money. We're talking about $70 billion, and that money could have been spent, could be spent in a lot more effective ways to boost small business job growth.
All right. To Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. I'm a small business owner in Durham, 13 employees. We do home repairs, and I've been in business 16 years. I've yet to make $250K. My goal for 2011 is to make $255, so I'll gladly pay extra tax on $5,000 out of appreciation for this wonderful country. And if I may make another point,
sure.
I think the Republicans' bogus claim, excuse me, in my opinion, a bogus claim that the fat cats are afraid to hire because they're afraid they'll lose their charity, I think that's bogus. Small companies like mine and large companies hire when and only when their company will benefit from having another employee or another 100 employees.
That's absolutely true. I think that what businesses, what you're seeing when economic statistics come out, what you're seeing is that businesses will do almost anything before they begin hiring if they're unsure that they're able to use those additional employees. They'll work the employees that they have longer hours. They'll make part-time people full-time. But they really do, because of the cost, the added cost, it's not just an employee's salary, it's the benefits, et cetera. And it's also the cost of retaining them and the idea that should you have another downturn, which has been predicted by some, that you'd have to let those individuals go.
All right. To Flint, Michigan. Good morning, Bryce.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
wonderful show today. Really, really great. I'm really enjoying it. I just wanted to make one comment and a question about taxes. On the comment, from the gentleman who keeps saying that you don't raise taxes because it kills jobs during a recession, Reagan raised taxes, okay? Clinton raised taxes, and we saw a huge job growth. So that's simply not true. The question, why don't we ever talk about payroll tax cuts? I hear about income tax cuts, capital gains, business. But if we want to spur demand, excuse me, I'm sorry.
What do you think, Bill?
Well, first, on the 1990s and the tax increases then, there was also a capital gains tax cut. And you also had huge investment with preparing for the Y2K issue. So, you know, it's kind of apples and oranges. But in terms of a payroll tax holiday, the first thing we at the NFIB argued for when we were talking about a stimulus was a payroll tax cut holiday. I mean, that's money that the business pays immediately. I mean, you have to pay it quarterly. So it comes right out of
your
cash flow.
You're talking about money that goes into the Social Security fund. I don't understand why we keep calling that a payroll tax. This is money for Social Security.
Well, it's tax based on your payroll, so that's why it's called a payroll tax.
But it gets hidden in people's minds.
Well, and there's actually three components to it. There's Social Security, there's Medicare, and then also at the state level and the federal level, it's unemployment insurance. And one of the things we've seen in a lot of states, Nevada, for example, just recently talked about increasing the portion of their unemployment tax by 50% to deal with the shortfalls they have because they basically drain their unemployment funds. So, you know, the same businesses that were saying, hey, we need to get you out there and hiring are seeing other kinds of tax increases, not just their income taxes.
All right, let's go to, I think it's Mattapoisett, Massachusetts. Is that right, Paul?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, sir. Go right ahead.
Yeah, well, I have a small business. We make boats. There are three of us here. People have somewhat made the point I wanted to make, but especially Jacob there. But I would hire people if there were less downside risk to hiring. And for example, if it doesn't work out, it'll cost me about $15,000 in unemployment insurance.
What do you mean?
To lay somebody off.
What do you mean if it doesn't work out?
Well, if I think I have enough business to hire somebody.
I see.
And either the person doesn't work out or the business falls off later, that's a huge cost down the road. And I haven't heard anybody anywhere talk about lessening that risk, you know, in the same way that we bail out Wall Street when they take a risk.
Good point. Go ahead, Bill.
He's exactly right. I mean, part of the risk of bringing on a new employee in these tough economic times are, you know, if you do have that downturn, you have to let them go. State unemployment taxes are called experience rated. It's based on how long or if someone's been laid off from your business. So your tax rate relative to that tax goes up if you lay somebody off. So you kind of get hit by the double whammy. And at the federal level, back in the late 1970s, when we depleted the unemployment insurance fund then, we added a surtax to the federal tax. It was a temporary surtax. Here we are, 2010. That temporary surtax is still in place. So these are the kind of problems that small businesses face when we talk about, you're listening to small businesses. These are big tax increases that come right out of your bottom line every quarter. And when you increase that tax and you call it temporary, and here we are 30 plus years later, that's not temporary.
To Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Brett.
Good morning, Diane. Great show.
Thanks.
I completely agree. I've never made a decision. I've been in business 20 years. I've never made a business decision on tax cuts. But I run a contracting business here in Dallas, and one thing that I never hear about in this debate is enforcement of our labor laws. And I compete every day against people that use illegal immigrants as labor, and I believe exploit them. I pay Social Security. I give them health care and benefits and all that kind of stuff. And I lose jobs, and I know a lot of good contractors out there that lose jobs every day because we can't compete on a labor front. Hmm. And I never hear that in this debate.
Elizabeth.
I think this is typical of some of the concerns that are raised by small businesses out in the field, but they are not raised in Washington. Or they are, but they're just not on the plate yet. The legislative agenda so far has not included immigration reform. But I was just looking at this list of tax cuts that the president has said that have been, you know, 16 tax cuts enacted for small businesses. And again, this is where you really see the problem with a definition in what is a small business. Because if you have 500 employees, you would still fit the SBA definition of a small business, and you could benefit from the 5-year carryback on net operating losses, or the 75% exclusion of small business capital gains, or bonus depreciation. If you are a t-shirt maker or a t-shirt printer, you may not benefit from that. I talked with a pizzeria owner who said, you know what the biggest deal was in those 16 tax cuts? It was my ability to write off cell phone charges. This was a huge deal for this man because he operates 6 pizzerias, he has a number of employees, and they're constantly communicating with each other. So there is a disconnect both in the definition and both in the remedy that's devised by Washington and what's really needed by small businesses in places like Texas.
I think that the caller raises a larger issue, which is many small business owners don't feel that they get to compete on a level playing field with each other or with large corporations. And I'll just mention another aspect of that. If you work hard and play by the rules, in Bill Clinton's term, and provide health insurance to your workers, you may face a really tough competitive situation. And one of the things that the health care bill will hopefully do is make it easier for firms to provide coverage in an affordable way so that there isn't that tilted playing field. But how did the playing field get tilted? And then you get back to winner-take-all politics. You know, you get back to the fact that in Washington, we have the golden rule, he who has the gold rules. And the lobbyists are not representing, for the most part, small businesses. I mean, the NFIB is an organization that's out there. But right now, if you look at where the money is, it's coming from the largest corporations who have been lobbying on financial regulation and healthcare to reflect their interests. So anytime these regulations come down the pike, they get tilted in ways that they're going to help the richest of the rich. And we have a winner-take-all economy, and you see that in what gets counted as small business, too. And I'll just mention one example of that, which is apropos of what you were saying about Cindy McCain. In partnerships with over $50 million in receipts, those accounted for 2/3 of all partnership income, but they only accounted for 0.2% of all tax returns. So what we're really talking about, right, is the money is concentrated at the very, very top. And these are not what we think of when we think of small businesses.
But why do we keep defining them that way? Why does the government continue to create these definitions through which these loopholes can be created? I mean, Bill, I'm truly not trying to attack small business. What I am really upset about, and I think lots of people are, is the idea that there is such mush about these definitions that people can worm their way through.
Well, I mean, some of this is the challenge. And we go back to Rick Poor in Nebraska. I mean, he's clearly a small business.
Absolutely.
But he's not going to get that small business tax credit. So, you know, I mean, this is part of the challenge with trying to identify small business within various laws. And then when you get to the other challenge with something like that tax credit, it costs money. So you have to limit it to keep the revenue down.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Findlay, Ohio. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Yes, ma'am. I just have a quick point. Since the $250,000 is such a kind of the magic bullet, everybody's like me. I'm a working stiff. You know, I'm outraged that perhaps the Bush tax era tax cuts might continue to be extended for those the wealthiest people. Well, why couldn't? Isn't there any way that they can amend those tax cuts so that it would, you know, moderate people's opinions, like maybe put up $1 million? You know, because obviously small businesses sometimes, you know, $250,000, you know, even somebody like me that doesn't make that much money doesn't feel like that's a terrific sum. But somebody making $1 million or more, I you know, I don't want them getting a benefit from furthering tax cuts.
I do understand that, Elizabeth.
Well, the president's answer to that, Diane, and to the caller, has been to eliminate that upper bracket and to keep the tax cuts for the middle class. And that hasn't gone anywhere. So that's sort of at the crux of the debate. The other alternative is to overhaul the entire code and to provide some additional benefits for middle class people and business owners.
So where do you see this argument going?
It depends on the composition of Congress after November 2nd. It really does.
And, you know, it's as though the president is almost ready to compromise.
He has sent signals in that direction, as has John Boehner, the majority leader.
But then he backed off. John Boehner backed off What do you see happening?
Well, I think this is a perfect illustration of winner-take-all politics, because what we've seen is essentially the Republican Party has gotten pulled to the right by the rise of business, the organization of business, the role of big money in politics. But the Democratic Party has been really cross-pressured. You know, it stands for the little guy, but at the same time, it needs to raise money. There's a great quote from Rahm Emanuel where he's talking about how he was able to get this, get back Congress, where he says that during a campaign, basically in the first phase, you need to have money, money, money. In the second phase, you've got to have money, money, press. And in the third phase, you have to have money, press, and votes. And for those keeping score at home, that's money 6, votes 1. So money matters a lot, and money has pulled both parties. And that's why the Democrats, a big chunk of the Democrats, just weren't willing to take on this issue, even though it was a winner with the public. And it's just a really misleading issue, as we've been discussing.
Jacob Hacker, he and Paul Pearson have together written Winner Take All Politics. Elizabeth Williamson is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Bill Risch is tax counsel for the National Federation of Independent Business. Thank you all so much. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.